2007 will come to order. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 8.
Oh, he's gone. Are you coming back?
Representative Olson?
Yeah, he's coming back.
We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 859.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Butler?
I move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of being able to reconsider the bill, or the vote by which Senate Bill 859, as they engross, passed out of the Senate or out of the House Revenue Committee.
Thank you, Representative Butler. The motion is not debatable and requires a two-thirds vote. Are there any objections to suspending the rules? Six members here. I don't see any objections, so the motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move that the A6 amendment be appended to. Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 859 was sent to the floor with a due pass amended recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves that we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 859 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion is carried.
Mr. Chair, I move the A6 amendment.
Again, another one?
Yep.
Are you serious?
Yep.
We rescind the A5 amendments to Senate Bill 859.
Representative Butler moves that the committee rescind its amendment of the bill with the A5 amendments. Is there objection to that motion?
You're supposed to do this.
Seeing no objection, the motion is carried.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I understand that the A6 amendment replaces the A5 amendment.
Yes.
And that it fixes a glitch to actually prescribe the correct dates and the implementation so as to provide the opportunity for the Non-Game Wildlife Fund to have checkoff for the program, have the correct date and a correct life expectancy.
Yes.
On the face of the Form 40 income tax returns. And so I make that motion.
Representative Butler moves the -6 amendment. Just by way of additional discussion, let me point out that what this basically does is deals with an internal conflict in the bill. And as I understand it, the essential change is on page 6 of the amendment, line 7, which inserts on January 2nd, 2012 in the bill. Anything else, Chris?
No, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Everything else is the same as is in the -5.
Everything is the same. The glitch was that because the bill has an emergency clause, that date had to be in the section that repealed it.
Thank you.
As well as...
Right. And I'm just very pleased that Legislative Council caught this before the bill went to the floor. We'd have to do all of this stuff on the floor. This is better. Any further discussion on the -6 amendments? Seeing none, is there objection to the -6 amendments? Seeing none, the -6 amendments are adopted.
Mr.
Representative Butler.
I move Senate Bill 859, as amended with the A6 of June 6th, be moved to the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves Senate Bill 859, as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Please call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Excused.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Rosenthal.
Excused.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Chair Barnhart.
Aye. The motion, having received the required majority, is adopted, and the bill goes to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gelser was carrying.
Representative Gelser will carry this amendment as well, and we hope that she likes it. And with that, we close the work session on Senate Bill 859 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3498.
An overview?
Yes, please.
House Bill 3498 has some definitions beginning that the majority of the bill pertains to Section 3, which allows a county to sell or transfer delinquent property taxes, including penalties and interest, to private or public parties, but requires that the county retain its duty to collect the taxes, hereafter referred to as receivables in the bill. the county is authorized to negotiate the terms of the sale or transfer agreement. The proceeds from the sale or transfer shall be deposited into an account designated as the unsegregated tax receivable sales account, and these funds shall be distributed to the local districts, taxing districts, in proportions that are specified under current law. Prohibits the county from transferring any of the proceeds from the sale or transfer of the receivables to the county assessment and taxation fund. And then further, sections 4 and 6 modify the state school fund formula by changing the definition of local revenues to subsection 10K to provide for 10% of any monies from these sales to go into the school fund, and modifies that provision by two different dates. There is an amendment to this bill, dash 1, which changes the process substantially by granting each taxing district the authority to direct the county tax collector to collect or transfer these delinquent taxes. It also adds to what can be collected other charges, which are undefined at this moment, to the list of receivables. So the property, the taxes could be sold to third parties. Other charges could be added to the amount that the county would have to collect for the taxing district. And these would then be sold and transferred to third parties. The local taxing district would negotiate the terms of the sale and all receivables for the sale of its portion only of the receivables. It would require that the county would collect and transfer directly to the local taxing districts any funds received from the purchasers. And in Section 8, the additional language clarifies that nothing in this subsection shall be construed to allow the county to require a different standard of performance for collection of these taxes. Under current law, I should say that in 2005, delinquent taxes totaled roughly $210 million, of which 55% reflected taxes that were delinquent for less than a year, and about 90% were less than 3 years old, after which foreclosure proceedings can begin.
Thank you. I have a list of those who are opposed to the bill. Is there anyone here who was intending to testify in favor of the bill? I don't see anybody. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3498 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 954.
That's why I just got to look at it, see who was behind it.
It's just a committee bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 954 comes to you from the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. And what I've done is I'll start with the back of the revenue impact statement to show you conceptually what the bill is designed to do. It establishes a shared services fund, and it requires firms that receive property tax relief under the Strategic Investment Program, or the SIP program, to report average employment and wages to the Department of Economic and Community Development on an annual basis. Those employment and wages are estimated, and I'll refer to this chart that says a conceptual mechanics behind Senate Bill 954. For an eligible future strategic investment project, and you can see in the bill it's for projects that first become eligible for the property tax exemption, which is the SIP program, if you recall, caps assessed value at $100 million. Anything above that is exempt. And for rural SIPs, it's $25 million. A project that's an investment that's eligible for the SIP that's sponsored by the Economic Development Department and approved by the county commissioners would have a certain amount of employment and wages identified with that. And what the bill does is require the Department of Economic Development to track those, which they do on a regular basis now, and report those on an annual basis. And let's say, for example, that employment in my conceptual mechanics here is 350 and average wages are $42,500. For that amount of labor income, if we look on our personal income tax table and see for that amount of income what would be tax collections, so this would not be applying a marginal rate but simply average tax collections for that amount of income, is $2,333. And what the bill would do is require the Department of Administrative Services to estimate the taxes associated with this. In this case, it's $2,333 times the 350 employees. Apply a ratio to be shared with the counties, which is half, which is 0.5. And then you would see that the deposit in the Shared Services Fund would be $408,000. So if those dollars are deposited in the Shared Services Fund, they then go back to the taxing districts who lost revenue from the tax exemption. So it's a means of sharing revenue, income tax revenue, that was generated by employment in the Strategic Investment Program with the taxing districts who were affected by the property tax exemption. So that's the concept behind it. I do have a revenue impact statement there for you on the other side. It is designed to apply to tax years beginning in 2009. The first calculation would be done following that year, which would be in the spring of 2010. And based on our estimates, what we know of existing projects and expected rate of new projects in the future, we're estimating a loss in 2009-11 of general fund revenue about $600,000, and then a gain, of course, to the Shared Services Fund. So it's an effect of fund shift between state government and those eligible local governments. And then in 11-13, I've assumed that, and I do know that there is a project coming online at that time that would generate about 1,500 employment in 2012. So I've estimated that in the 11-13 numbers for a $4.5 million for the full two-year period available to be transferred into the Shared Services Fund. I will point out, of course, that the SIP program is, there's only a few projects right now. I believe there are six projects that are operating now under the program. So there's only a few of them, and some of them potentially can be quite large. So there's obviously a lot of margin of error here. I guess the positive thing is if you end up with a larger revenue loss, it means there's a lot more jobs that have been created through the SIP. So it's very much kind of a discrete decision that's made by individual companies. And the company that, of course, has been most active under this program, that's had the biggest impact on the state, is Intel.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I follow a couple of questions?
Absolutely. Yes.
You said, Paul, there are six projects currently, SIPs. Are any of them the 25,000, the rural, or the 25 million rural?
I'll ask the county folks to address that. My understanding is that the newest project, Genentech, is actually qualifies as a rural because it's outside the urban growth boundary.
Okay.
So it has to be outside the urban growth boundary.
And under this proposal, is this only for new SIP or it applies to old ones as well as new ones?
Representative Berger, it would apply to projects that become eligible for the property tax exemption after January 108,
okay.
And the transfer would first apply to tax year 2009, would be made after that year. There is an amendment to the bill, -A6, and this is really just an amendment that we requested working with the Senate to Revenue Committee based on some clarification of issues that came up in the discussion in the Senate. And the A6s are designed to take care of a few things. For example, the deletion, the first on page 2, lines 34 to 38 of the bill. Does everybody have the A6s?
No.
No.
Oh.
No.
Okay. We'll get everyone a copy of the A6s. But the A6 amendment is designed to clear up a couple of things, and I'll make sure we have copies of that. Apparently that wasn't distributed.
Okay. So, well, maybe we could take your testimony and distribute that, and you can talk about it.
These don't affect the concept of the bill.
And I also would like a deal for my file on the Senate votes. Is that in there?
I think it's attached to our...
There it is. I've lost it.
Thank you. Somebody's handing it.
Oh, the journal. Yeah. The journal. It's in here.
Oh, I found it. I found my own. Thank you.
Another question for staff, if I may, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that local governments, by proportion, as agreed up front before the actual SIP program begins, so that particular county would agree amongst the local governments and amongst the various taxing service districts how they would share any SIP money that would be created in the shared services fund. Is that correct?
That's correct. We have Commissioner Bryan is here, too, to talk about how that's worked in the past, and that would be seen as working similarly. The districts, it would be distributed according to the revenue that would be lost from the exemption.
Right, okay.
Those affected districts.
And I just wanted to make that clear for the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Tom Bryan, Dennis Mulvihill.
Make sure you're doing that, Dennis Mulvihill.
Yes. Tom Hughes?
That's correct. You followed me home. Can I keep him? Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tom Bryan. I'm chairman of the Washington County Board of Commissioners. We very much appreciate your time today to talk about 954, and I understand your schedule, and we'll make our side of the conversation as brief as possible.
We saved some time just a minute ago.
Yes. I noticed how you did that, and that was, I agreed with that one. And this one's eligible for the same treatment, by the way, except in a positive way. Mr. Chairman, we do appreciate this. That we see this bill having the result of assisting us with future negotiations, giving us an additional tool, as well as assisting local governments and making it more equitable for jurisdictions that do participate in the SIP. The state law, the intention in 1993 and the way we have used the SIP statutes is to help attract magnates who help us develop clusters. And we have focused on that consistently since 1993. And the results have been companies such as Intel who have helped trigger an incredible cluster, and they do business with some 300 Oregon companies buying and selling products and services. And last year we started, I think, what will grow to be a very significant second cluster in Genentech, biopharmaceutical, biotherapeutic, biomed company. And I believe the signs are they will also be attracting their own cluster, and they're kind of counter-cyclical to chips. The economy doesn't really affect them. You need medicine for cancer for yourself or your loved one, you're going to pursue it. And then most recently, Solar World joined Washington County, and although they did not participate in the SIP, we have already had contact by other global solar voltaic cell development companies who do tell us they need a SIP and want to explore coming to Washington County to be next to these others and the silicone and so forth. So we think it's been an extremely effective program to have available, not only for Washington County and the region, but statewide. And you know all the numbers, I think, about overall revenues and statewide impact and all of that. And, of course, this is this bill we're asking for would be for 50% of the income tax generated by specifically identified and approved or certified jobs coming out of these future revenues. And these are very hard to put together sometimes. I've chaired two Intel and one Genentech negotiations, and they've been very difficult, close to not happening and so forth. And it's very important to, I feel, give local jurisdictions around the state every tool they can. We know of jurisdictions who have, in fact, not proceeded with an SIP opportunity because it didn't pencil for them. And so we think it's very helpful and very important in that respect. We look at it as partially equity. In the Genentech deal, the state was very effective in working with us, and they put in about $6 or $7 million into that package. Our final negotiation put about $27 million in. The state, because of the income tax, retrieves their $6.5 million, $6 or $7 million in about 22 to 24 months. We keep giving for 15 years. And so our service demand goes up, and property revenue is forgone. And the mayor, of course, has a real local handle on that because several of these have been in the Washington County or Hillsborough area, I mean. So we think it's just a very important tool. We think it's equitable. In reference to, Mr. Chairman, to Representative Butler's question, every SIP requires us to file with the economic OECD a distribution plan for the community fee portion of the package. So that's already defined and on file before the SIP is even approved. This program then is required. The money will be distributed exactly in the same proportions. So there, we don't even need to strike a new agreement on this. It just follows the original agreement for distribution of community service fee. I'm going to control myself and stop there, Mr. Chairman. We very much appreciate your consideration of this. We think it's very important, and we think it's important statewide. To help the, I know when I've spoken with other counties around the state, it's a very close call, and we also have to maintain public support. And the public will ask folks like us, why are you giving away all these property tax dollars, increasing our traffic and everything else while you're giving up these property tax dollars? This will help us explain all of the benefits, and this will be one more thing we can say, well, by the way, we get some back this way. And I think we have to maintain public support, else you won't see county commissions and city councils around the state stepping up to do this. Thank you.
Mr. Mayor.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to come before you today to speak in support of Senate Bill 954. For the record, my name is Tom Hughes. I'm the mayor of the city of Hillsborough, and we are the, the official language is the domicile city for five of the six SIPs that are in existence in the state of Oregon. I've actually been mayor through the negotiations application of three of those, the last two Intel SIPs and the Genentech SIP. I think I would comment just in passing. One of the we don't come before you today to plead the pity poor us that we have to take this huge burden to bring these big companies into our community and into our county. Hillsborough made a decision back in the 1970s that we did not want to become a bedroom community, that we wanted to create jobs within the community that would provide work for the citizens of the community so they wouldn't have to commute into Portland and back and forth each day. In the process of doing that, we have used the SIF as the tool, the really primary tool to bring Intel's initial investment and their subsequent investments into the community. There are, by our estimates, somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 to 40 other companies operating in Hillsborough that are in Hillsborough because they can stand with their back up against their factory and throw a rock and hit Intel. That's an important consideration, and it's the magnet effect that Commissioner Bryan was talking about before. That using this tool has provided us with an opportunity to really realize the vision that we had for our community back in the 1970s. But I would have to tell you that it is not without cost. Our fire department is a different kind of a fire department than in communities of our size that don't have Intel, that don't have FEI, that don't have TriQuint, that don't have some of the other large high-tech companies. We do more hazmat training. We have more hazmat material. We have bigger equipment, additional costs that are borne by the community as being the hometown for all of these companies. We do it because it is who we are. And what we're saying here essentially is that on the revenue side, we sacrifice revenue in order to be that kind of city. The result is that the state benefits from that dramatically in the form of income tax collected from the jobs that are brought to our community by these companies. What we're asking for, I think, is a fairly reasonable compromise. It is a share of the income tax from those jobs directly created by the SIP. We're not asking anybody to estimate how many other jobs are created in the multiplier effect that bringing these jobs to our community has. So we're really looking at a minimal and marginal request for what income tax revenue should be recorded. In our case, as Chair Bryan said, the last two SIPs have been painfully negotiated. I think that they've been, there have been occasions when it looked like virtually everybody was going to walk away from the table. And part of that is driven by an understanding on the part of the county and the city representatives at the table at how much we can afford to give up in order to get that benefit. This opportunity, I think, would make that a much easier thing for other communities to look at and say, this SIP makes sense for us. And so I think what you will do with this bill actually is that even though the effect right now is pretty predominantly in Washington County, I think you'll see the effect of this bill spread to other counties as other communities begin to say, this is something we can do, this makes sense to us, because the revenue that we'll get back from the income tax will be the thing that tips the balance. So I'd be happy to end there and just answer whatever questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Question? Yes, Representative Byrne.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Mayor, for your testimony. Is there any way to guesstimate how much you're able to claw back by doing this? I know it's going to vary on every single employer. I mean, do you have a goal what your clawback is?
No, I think in reality, each of these SIPs has been slightly different. And so, for example, the initial Intel SIP was to encourage them to build a fab in Oregon. And we knew that with that SIP would come a large relocation of some of their workers, and the growth in Intel in Hillsboro, which went from a relative handful back in their first installation to about 16,000 now, really proceeded from that first SIP. Most of that SIP actually went to the school districts because it was deemed that the schools really were going to bear the brunt of most of that growth. The subsequent Intel SIPs, we really think are marginal in terms of creating additional jobs, but they're essential in terms of holding the job level where it is. Intel has an opportunity to shift production to other locations around the country and around the world, and where they reinstall their new equipment is a decision that's very, very carefully made by them, and the SIP has been a real important asset for that. So we think it's valuable, but it doesn't create additional jobs. So on those SIPs, I mean, they're fairly substantial abatements, but they don't create a lot of they wouldn't create a lot of additional income tax revenue. The Genentech, really, we don't know because we get their estimates of what their job in Oregon are going to be, and we quite frankly think that's pretty low. So that could be in the 300 to 400 range.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up quickly?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would guess that you would argue that this, you don't think this will hurt your negotiating position at all. As you're negotiating the SIP and the company or the companies you're dealing with, tell me why they're not going to come back and say, well, don't worry about it because you're going to get half the income tax back anyway.
Chair Barnard, Representative Bruna, I think that actually Chair Bryan probably has a better handle on that because he's actually been at the table. But what I would say in passing is that that quite frequently we're more knowledgeable and more concerned about the structure of what we're doing than the company is. The company really looks at the bottom line, it's not like a labor negotiation, for example, where the union is apt to say, well, we looked at your budget and you have X amount in contingency so you can afford to. These folks really don't know. They really debate it on a different level, I think, than that.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Brun, I think that through the process, and everyone I've been involved in, they'll fly in their attorneys and CPAs and so forth, very sharp people. There's no question in my mind they'll be aware of this additional benefit and they'll try to use it. I mean, they'll say, well, why be so hardball on that? You guys are getting 50% back. And we'll say, no, that's for this. That's not on the table. You know, we'll try that. But ultimately, when I mentioned, it gives us more tools. Every deal is different. And it whether we can keep it off the table and use it for services, or whether we end up saying, okay, we can give a little bit here because we have this, and we end up making a deal where we might not have made one before. But I'd rather have the tool than not have the tool, because we can control the yes or no on that. And Mr. Chairman, while I'm speaking, Mr. Mulvihill presented me with information that to the community. There are 11 operating SIPs in the state of Oregon. Two are in Multnomah County, one in Union County, one in Sherman, one in Clatsop, and six in Washington County that have either are or have been. Like one of the ones in Washington County has run its course 15 years. But so there's 11 current operating SIPs, and I think we have one that's just closing out. Generally, they're 15 years each, which is the length of this income tax benefit, by the way, would be limited to the length of the SIP agreement.
Thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand that school districts may lose some money through the SIP, and I'm just wondering if this legislation in any way envisions making them whole.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Chairman and Representative Witt, there's quite a history here. Bottom line is, to the extent that their property tax isn't collected, obviously the way the state school funding formula works, they're made whole through that process. Some would say, yeah, but now that's a bigger tap on the statewide pool. It's a very small amount, relatively. We have looked at that and discussed it with them. And, of course, we and they would argue that we're net exporters in substantial scale anyway, so that this shouldn't bother anyone. Now, over and above that, we are sensitive, as the mayor indicated, in the early SIPs, where this was very job-related. These SIPs were going to bring hundreds of jobs. Out of $24 million of the first two SIPs in actual paid property tax revenue, $22 million of the $24 million, we essentially voluntarily gave to the schools, local schools, because we said, we're doing okay, you're definitely going to be affected by this. Now, the 99 SIP, which was my first one to negotiate, we separately met with the school superintendents, explained what was going on. It was primarily a job retention because we had to retool a couple existing plants, so we risked departures. But we still offered $500,000 a year. So during and we did it in 5-year increments. So we gave them $2.5 million every 5 years. And we started talking about how we distribute it. And I said, you know, pardon me, the way I'd like this to work is the superintendents get in a room, I run in and put $2.5 million on the table and run. And you folks sort out, you guys sort out what's equitable. And that's what they've done. And the county's renewed that $2.5 million for a second 5 years, and we anticipate continuing to do that. The 2005 Intel SIP, which covers $25 billion of investment through 2025, whenever that kicks into gear, we told the schools, you know, we don't know what their circumstance or our circumstance or how fast the flow is or when they activate it, and we promise in good faith to sit down and talk with you then. And they've accepted that because of the way they've been treated over the years. And so that's kind of how that goes. It's in our county, we meet with our superintendents, we meet with them early and say, we've received this application, here's what it looks like. Everything we know today is it's a retention, not a new job And so your minimal classroom impact, and they look it over, and if they agree, which they did in the 99, is that that was fine. So we're very aware of the service impacts, whether they be fire and police and our transportation or education, because this has to work for everyone. Beginning back to my public support, you know, we've had the school district come in and support at our public hearings on these every time.
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, these there are 11 current SIPs with 15-year limited life. Those new folks who come forward as a result of Senate Bill 954 that we're considering today and participate through the deposits to the shared services fund that we're creating, the shared services fund actually sunsets in 2019, I believe. How that won't give us the 15-year life. What happens between if these folks get up and running so that we start to divert the 50% of the personal income tax collections in 2008 or 2009, and this program goes for 10 years beyond that? I need to reconcile that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I suspect either myself or my predecessor will be coming down talking to you or your predecessor saying we need an extension on the shared services account, but I'd certainly defer to Mr. Warner on his thoughts on that.
Representative Butler, if you notice on the at the end of the bill on the page 3 on section 5, it does require that the Economic Community Development Department report to the appropriate House and Senate committees relating to revenue on or before May 1, 2013. And that was...
And so that would be the time then that you would consider the re-upping this particular program.
That was explicitly put in by the Senate Revenue Chair.
Okay.
You notice that's exactly, well, not quite 6 years before that expiration date. Mm-hmm.
Follow-up question, then, on me, and still dealing with the dates of these. As I read the amendment, the A6 amendment, lines 12 through 15, the property tax exemption on or after 2008. I guess that ties into the same thing. Continue to apply only so long as the project remains exempt. So that what happens is that would have to be re-upped at that time too.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. And then just for my own edification, the total cost of the project cannot exceed $100 million or $25 million if it's located in a rural area for a SIP. What are the amounts that we're talking about for investment of the current projects that would be exempt from taxation? Again, getting back to local share and more specifically Representative Witt's question relative to the school share.
Representative Butler, you're asking about the amount of exempt property?
Yes, sir.
In 05-06, there was $4.7 billion in assessed property that was exempted under the program, and primarily due to the very large values associated with the semiconductor facilities, particularly Intel's.
Primarily machinery, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Personal
yeah.
property.
Yes.
$4.7 billion.
In 05-06, $4.7 billion in assessed property was exempt. So the amount of tax revenue would be about 1.5% of that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want you to know that I am becoming a little more sensitive as I read articles about how corporations are getting away with bloody murder in Oregon, that we're trying to attract new jobs, new businesses, new investment into these communities. And I, as we do this, the same folks that are crying foul that corporations are doing very well, thank you, but not paying their share, need to be at the table at the same time telling us, hey, these corporations will be doing well, but they're still not paying their share, whatever that is. And that, for your edification, that isn't the way I necessarily feel I feel like the family wage jobs that are brought into the communities certainly overcomes much of the SIP advantage that we may be giving here. So I am anxious that those same folks will come back and do an analysis in 3 or 4 years and say, look what these folks are getting away with. Or when we try and improve the Pearl District and somebody comes along and says, look what Portland, what foolish things Portland did with those beautiful apartments that are now in downtown Portland. So I'm just anxious that, that you know, we have great 2020 eyesight right in this process.
Mr. Chairman, may I address that?
Yes, please.
Thank you. I think that Representative Butler's question speaks directly to this public support issue because, we, in the end, we have to have their support for to do these. One of the policies we've just adopted on our own since 1999 is that these SIP applicants must pay normal freight on their land and building because the land and the building itself isn't anything special. All of our businesses have land and building, as do our homes have land and building, and they have to pay normal freight on that. Where we focus the discussion, really, once we convince them that we're serious about that, is on this equipment. And if you take a high-tech company, for example, their equipment may be fit on generally on this table, maybe a little larger, and be $5 to $7 million per copy, and they have 7 acres of these.
With a shelf life of 5 years.
With a shelf life of 5 years. So if we actually tax them at full and ordinary rate on that equipment, well, they wouldn't be here. Our system, the way I viewed it, the old revenue hat of mine, our system just wasn't built for that kind of value. And if we don't do something and negotiate down a par rate, they won't be here. And that's really where we are.
As I say, Tom, I don't necessarily subscribe to that personally,
right,
because the family wage jobs and then the residual value in the community plus the number of times those dollars turn in our communities is phenomenal.
Mr. Chairman, if I can just comment, I just have to, I'd like to tell this quick story. In 99, I had a gentleman call me and be very upset that we were considering this Intel deal, the first one that I was involved in. And you know, how can you give them this big tax break? And I start talking about the community benefits, the community value, and he was a barber. And I said, would you do me a favor? Here's my home phone number. The next 2 weeks, when you're cutting hair, ask people if they work at Intel or any other connection. You know, and it went on with time. I said, and please call me and let me know what you think. He called me about 2 weeks later, and he said, well, Mr. Bryan, I get, give them whatever they want. About half my hands are Intel heads in one shape or another. And it, to me, you think about car dealers, furniture salesmen, clothing, grocery stores, it all gets that rollout effect. It's a 2.5x on our economy versus
loads a lot of boats.
Their investment. So.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could also respond a little bit. And one of the things is, as the way this process works is that the county negotiates the SIP agreement, and then it has to pass usually a joint meeting with the county commissioners and city council. So we all get a chance to sit and listen to the testimony. And we often have citizens that say, you know, why don't you give us the same kind of tax break that you give Intel? And our response to that, because of the way we administer the tax abatement, is we give them exactly the same. Actually, we give them a little bit harsher treatment than you because we tax your land, we tax your house, we don't tax your flat screen TV, we don't tax your refrigerator. With Intel, we can tax up to the first 100 million of their equipment. So we think that this is an appropriate response in building community support for this kind of a program. As Thomas suggested, and as has been my experience, we need the extra tools, though, to be able to cut that deal that makes that a true statement when we look our citizens in the eye and say this is the way we're treating these corporations. And the second point that I would make just in passing, and I know that, Representative Butler, I know that you didn't say this, but this bill actually doesn't provide any tax abatement for industry at all. This simply shifts the revenue that is collected based on the arrival of new jobs and distributes it in a slightly different way than it did. But actually, to the industry itself, there is no direct benefit from this particular bill.
On the income tax. Right. Mr. Chairman, if I may just mention, I know that your time is short, and I was authorized to tell you that both Union and Lane County have offered their support. Union and Lynn have contacted us to offer their support for the bill, as has the Special District Association of Oregon.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. Other questions for this panel? I'm going to make an analogy, and it may not seem apt, but I think that it's a similar sort of technique that we're talking about. A couple of years ago, we looked at a bill that would, in fact, passed a bill that would have helped pay for the construction of a baseball stadium. And one of the ways of financing in that bill was to figure out what the income tax for the expensive players, baseball players, would have been, and apply that, or a portion of that, I forget exactly, to the cost of the stadium. That's a lot like what you're proposing, isn't it?
Incremental.
Because the idea is, if I understand it, the idea is, and I'm going to simplify a little bit, because we get to language that sometimes gets past me. What I think you're describing is that we bring in a new industry, or we continue an industry that otherwise might leave. We figure out what the we give them a property tax break in the process of doing that. Then the state figures out what income taxes the state received that it would not have received but for this business, and splits it as it were with the counties and other taxing agencies. Have I got the gist of it?
I think the gist, Mr. Chairman, I think the gist of it is exactly correct. We're dealing with a larger number of people who make a lot less money per year than baseball players.
Correct.
But other than that, I think the analogy is very apt.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I would like to add, however, that the community involvement and community support that these firms offer on a permanent basis, this 2.5x rollout.
I would not compare them to a baseball stadium.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
Right.
The metaphor breaks down.
Yeah,
yes.
Permanency and the family wage jobs versus concessionaires and things like that is a big difference.
Thank you. Others, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We also have, now, I'll ask for Mr. Mulvihill again if he's here, and Kelly Ross. Oh, okay. You were signed up. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Ross representing the Special Districts Association. I just wanted to confirm Chair Bryan's comment that we are in strong support of the bill, have been consulting with them since the bill's inception, and hope you'll give it your positive support.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on Senate Bill 954? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 954 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 819.
Chair, Senate Bill 819 again comes from Senate Revenue and Finance, and it's a complete amendment to the original Senate Bill 819 that was brought forward by the Governor's Office as a way to deal with the some of the unanticipated effects of large kicker credits. As you recall, we've talked about this issue in a couple of House bills, that when you have a kicker refund for individuals or a kicker credit for corporations, current law requires that kicker percentage be determined based on after credit liability, which is your total tax liability after you've taken all credits. What 819 would do is change that calculation for individual filers and corporate filers, and calculate a percentage based on your pre-credit liability, your liability in that top line before you adjust for credits. So the way it would work mechanically is you would have a smaller percentage. For example, instead of having a 21% credit now, I believe you have a 19.5% credit applied to a bigger base, your pre-credit liability. And then you'd go back through and calculate that. You do have one of the issues that we had talked about in the context of House Bill 3048, that you could create a situation where somebody's kicker credit is larger than their liability. So this bill does make the same adjustment you made in House Bill 3048, and that is it allows you to carry forward kicker credits. It applies to both personal and corporate, although the corporate kicker has been suspended for the coming biennium. One of the issues, the motivation, again, primarily behind this, is that those that end up purchasing credits or use credits, the effect of the kicker on those credits is to reduce the value of those credits. Whether it be, so if you're purchasing a credit, obviously it will become worth less. And this, of course, this issue came up when you discussed the energy credits, both Betsy and Retsy credits that you passed out of this committee and over to the Senate. So that's the motivation for doing it, to keep those credit values the same and not have the kicker somewhat randomly. And, of course, it is, particularly on the corporate side, it is a random effect based on the margin of error, and we've seen a lot of variation in the percentage difference. Kind of a secondary issue that came up as a result of this is, well, how would it affect taxpayers? And I'm sorry, I haven't had a chance to update this table, but it's very similar. This is the one we ran for the Senate. If you look on the table labeled distributional impact of Senate Bill 819, of course, it applies to the 2006 tax return. One of the things that happens is the credits are disproportionately a higher percentage of tax liability at lower incomes. One of the basic reasons for that is the biggest credit by far, 80%, is the personal exemption credit that everybody gets, and that's distributed evenly, but more higher percentage of income at the lower end. So if you look at that table, you can see how the 819 would affect the overall kicker. There is, of course, first of all, bottom line, no difference in the amount of kicker that's distributed. It's exactly the same. It's just distributed proportionally slightly differently, with lower income folks getting a slightly bigger average kicker, higher income folks getting a smaller kicker refund as a result of calculating on a pre-credit basis.
Thank you. Any questions about the summary? We have a number of witnesses who'd like to be heard today, so I ask indulgence of the witnesses to keep your remarks short. And if you have written testimony, be assured we'll look at that and ask you to hit your main points so that we can accommodate as many of the witnesses as possible. Barbara Bonham, Maureen Thomas, David Furr.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Would it be possible for a couple of other people to go ahead of us to
certainly
frame the issue?
Who do you have in mind?
Phil Nesmith is here from the Department of Energy, Jack Gusselman and Brian Doherty.
Thank you. Let's have them.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Doherty, Mr. Isselman, Mr. Nesmith. I'm easy.
But not cheap.
Gentlemen.
Afternoon.
Bill, please go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Bill Nesmith. I'm Assistant Director for Energy Conservation at the Oregon Department of Energy, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 819. Senate Bill 819 addresses a Department of Revenue statute that makes it a problem for companies to participate in the Business Energy Tax Credit program in particular, and to a lesser extent the Residential Tax Credit. And we believe that passage of 819 will correct this problem. And this bill also complements other priority legislation that this committee's passed, House Bill 2211 and 2212. And I'd be happy to answer any more detailed questions you might have.
Thank you.
Yes, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Brian Doherty. I'm with the Miller Nash Law Firm, and I'm testifying here on behalf of U.S. Bancorp. What I have handing out to you in my attachments are letters of support for this program from not only U.S. Bank, but the Oregon Bankers Association, the Oregon Business Association, and competitor law firm by the name of Stoll Rees. I'm carrying water for many people today. Who would have believed? I am here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 819. U.S. Bank is the largest purchaser of these business energy tax credits, and I might add, at strong encouragement from the state government. We have found that the unintended consequences of a kicker year makes this investment less valuable to them, and in some years, depending on the size of the kicker, and in particular the size or the amount of the bets you take, it can be a negative cost to the company. As a publicly traded company, we simply can't be getting into investments that have that type of questionable outcome. And what you've seen in this, I think Mr. Nesmith can talk about, is the precipitous drop in the number of investors in these programs. There is a simple fix. We believe Senate Bill 819 does that, and we're here to support it and certainly answer any questions if you have any.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Esselman of Tonkin Torp. I'm here today representing the tax practitioners at my firm and also the public accountants of Geffen Mesher PC. The problem, I think, has been aptly described. I just want to briefly comment on another consequence of inaction absent the change reflected in Senate Bill 819, and that specifically is that, and this is probably a particular interest to Representative Butler, tax advisors throughout the state will have what was historically sound and solid tax planning advice to their clients turn out not merely to be useless, but actually work to the detriment of their clients. And I've shared with you an example one of our tax practitioners put together. He creatively named the two taxpaying couples Sam and Sally Saint. They obviously participated in the Betsy program, and Terrence and Thelma Tightwad, who did not participate in the Betsy program. Under this scenario, the Saints do not fare as well without this change in SB 819 as the Tightwads do. So I will commend that to your later reference. There are others coming behind us who will talk about really the community value of these programs and the policy objectives that are employed when these tax credits are put to work. So I would just join the other witnesses who will come before you today, urge you to pass Senate Bill 819 and keep the promise we've made to our fellow Oregonian taxpayers. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate it. Now, Barbara, Maureen, and David.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today in strong support of Senate Bill 819. I'm not going to repeat what some of the others have, but I have a personal history in the Business Energy Tax Credit Pass-Through Program, and then until my retirement about a month ago from the Department of Energy, I was the person who found the partners for the pass-through projects, and that range started out the first year of the pass-through option program in finding partners for 34 projects, which totaled $1.3 million. And last year, by the end of 2006, we were finding partners for 1,861 projects, totaling $174 million. So the program success of continuing to find partners, and 100% of the pass-through projects in the last 5 years have had partners. And included in this, I think it's interesting to say that $2.5 million has been returned to state coffers from state agency energy projects. So I would just like to ask for your support. As the other representatives have said, Senate Bill 819 is the fix for this program. When we learned last year of the announcement by the state economist of the announcement of the kickers, we quickly found out, as did our partners like U.S. Bank, that it would have a huge negative impact on our program, and almost overnight our wonderful program number of partners became just a trickle. So I urge your support, and I have with me two other people who represent other parts of both the Business Energy Tax Credit Program and the Cultural Trust Program. I'd like to call on David Furr, who's the Facilities Director for the Salem-Keizer School District.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Barbara just gave me a big promotion.
Superintendent?
No. I am the utilities coordinator for the school district. My job is to review how we use utilities and to find ways to use less, thereby saving more money in operations.
Thank you. For the record, would you identify yourself?
Oh, sorry. David Furr.
Thank you.
I'm with Salem-Keizer School District. Since 2001, we have implemented more than 70 efficiency projects in our district, funded almost entirely through the Public Purposes Funds, which were part and parcel of Senate Bill 1149, as was passed in 2001, and the Betsy Pass-Through Program. I've listed a series of the types of projects, hot water heater upgrades in two middle schools and two high schools, which prevent us from having to fire our heating boilers in the summertime or non-heating times for the use of hot water. We have insulated schools that had no insulation or a bare minimum of insulation in their roofs and walls. We have implemented heating and cooling projects in six schools to ensure fresh air as needed, not when vacant, in large assembly areas. And we have replaced gymnasium lighting and other interior metal halide lighting in 52 gymnasiums, commons areas, et cetera, of our buildings. The total project costs are $1.7 million. We offset almost $426,000 of that through the use of Betsy pass-through funds. That's a full 25% of our project costs. The utility savings that we realize from these projects is on the order of $180,000 per year. For our district and for districts across the state, the Public Purposes Funds and the Betsy pass-through money have been a lifeline, allowing us to make critical improvements in times of drastic budget cutbacks. Our district has received energy efficiency project funds from pass-through partners participating in the Betsy program, both individuals, private citizens, and corporate. Other districts may have received more or less than ours, but the benefits of Betsy funds have been crucial for all Oregon schools. And I'd like to add that for small school districts, or small schools in particular, Betsy, these pass-through funds are extremely important. Due to limited funding resources that these districts must work with, and the fact that any single project would require a greater portion of their available funds. For example, we have, as a larger district, have funding that's available to us, which will allow us to pick and choose which schools, for example, we might want to put boilers in. A small district might require a boiler in one of their schools, and they will need to fund the entire project, and therefore the Betsy contribution would be a big factor in getting that single boiler in place. They could not install three-quarters of a boiler, for example. I will rely on you to read the rest of my statement. Thank you very much. I appreciate being here and having this opportunity.
Chairman Barnhart and members of the committee, it's my privilege to give testimony today on behalf of Senate Bill 819. Put my glasses on so I can read what I wrote. My name is Maureen Thomas, and I'm executive director of Mission Mill Museum here in Salem. It's a nonprofit that's not owned by the state and not owned by the city of Salem, and that's really important to my testimony. The Oregon Cultural Trust tax credit incentive for Oregon taxpayers has been a valuable asset for Mission Mill, and I have seen individual philanthropy to our organization as well as to other sister entities increase because of that opportunity, and I have often heard, why wouldn't I take advantage of that? And so it's a privilege to work with donors who have an interest in Oregon's culture and the progress that we're making here. The museum has applied twice to the Oregon Cultural Trust and been funded, once for the restoration of Mission Period 1841 houses that are the oldest wood frame houses in Oregon, and again for, and more recently, for the rehabilitation of one of Oregon's and Salem's only American treasure, the Thomas K. Woolen Mill. In total, $35,000 has been awarded from the trust in a competitive granting process. The last, which was $25,000 a couple of years ago, completed a match requirement by the National Park Service, which was our only federal grant that we have received to date, our first
not our only, our first. The Oregon Cultural Trust is an innovative funding mechanism designed to strengthen every aspect of Oregon's culture through the development of a permanent endowment. Established by the legislature in 2001, Oregonians have contributed at the end of 06 $10.3 million to the trust, allowing the trust to then award back $3.6 million in grants to statewide cultural organizations such as Mission Mill. So I urge your support of Senate Bill 819 today, which will allow individuals and corporate taxpayers to get full value of their tax credit as they participate with the Oregon Cultural Trust. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Are the Oregon Cultural Trust credits, are they saleable, and that's why those, I'm seeing Darcy Shager had no. How is it that the trust participates and it must participate by just the individuals who are giving, as opposed to sales? Okay, that answers my question. Thank you for shaking your head. Thank you for shaking your head. And Mr. Chair, I need to recognize Maureen Thomas, formerly from my district, House District 60, and a former Mrs. Oregon, too.
Wow. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Ricker.
I have to recognize this most excellent panel. Mr. Furr, I don't know personally, but he represents my school district for which I used to sit on the board, and obviously he does a very, very good job with this program on behalf of the students of the district. Maureen and I go back a long time. I've known her forever, and Barb is my neighbor.
I think you ought to declare a conflict of interest.
This is a really excellent panel.
It sounds to me, Representative, as though they were worried about your vote. Thank you very much. Anything else? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony on this bill. Randy Hildebrand, John Johnson, Rob Myers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randy Hildebrand. I'm a fourth generation Oregonian. I grew up on a family wheat ranch in north central Oregon. And unfortunately, due to the high costs of fuel and labor costs, we've been unable to be supported on the family farm. Most of my generation has had to leave the community and seek employment elsewhere. While I have enjoyed working in this building, I would really like to be able to go back to the family farm and work on ground that has been in the family for over 120 years. I'd like to testify in support of Senate Bill 819. Without the passage of this measure, small community wind projects, renewable energy projects, simply will not get off the ground. So I would urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sheriff Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Myers. I live in Condon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm here on behalf of the Community Renewable Energy Association and three Oregon counties who were fortunate enough to be situated along the Eastern Oregon Wind Corridor. I provided a letter in support of Senate Bill 819A from the Board of Directors of the Community Renewable Energy Association, and on behalf of Gilliam and Sherman and Huier counties, I would like to urge your support as well. This is an important piece of legislation for us because it represents a critical element in our ability to be able to grow and sustain rural communities. And for that reason, we respectfully urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chairman Barnhart and members of the committee, I am John Johnson. I am president of Bank of Salem here in town. I am also here in support of Senate Bill 819. And we, like U.S. Bank, have been involved in purchasing tax credits, and although quite a bit smaller than U.S. Bank, we've actually purchased over $2 million of tax credits since 2004. And most of the funds have gone to benefit Oregon Housing and Associated Services, also known as OHAS. They've used the money for transportation needs for buses for elderly and disabled here in the Willamette Valley. And without that funding, it would be much harder for them to provide the transportation to meet the needs of our community. Long story short, just in 2006, we utilized $450,000 of tax credits. If the corporate kicker would have gone through, even at a 35%, we would have lost about $160,000 in income. And With that, we would not really be able to support this type of program with that kind of loss. And so I really urge you to correct what I believe is incorrect on the accounting for this and the way the taxes are calculated.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel, Representative Berger?
Not a question, Mr. Just one more comment. Mr. Johnson, we had a discussion earlier about the churn effect of good business, and I think Mr. Johnson's bank is truly representative of what a small, no disrespect to the big U.S. bank, but I think he speaks volumes for how a small local bank can use a program like this to do a lot of wonderful things, keeping money going in the community and having it grow. So congratulations to him, and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would simply like to add my comment to that issue. There are a number of smaller banks in the communities that I represent as well, and they're very important to the community and to the programs like Oregon Housing and so forth. And we appreciate the activities of the smaller banks.
Thank you
very much, Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, this is a question for staff. I'm now, you know, after the last couple of bills here, I'm beginning to wonder, when we report corporate tax liability of the banking institutions in Oregon or other corporate institutions in Oregon, we're actually reporting based upon the net amount of collections after these business energy tax credits, after the all of the credits. Is that correct?
Representative, under current law, the percentage calculation is going to be based on your total liability after you've taken all your credits.
Okay.
What this would do is just move it up two lines.
Exactly. Exactly. So really, I guess my concern is this. What this is demonstrating is that we have some folks here that want to encourage the good public policy as is passed in 838 and other good public policy bills as passed in this and prior legislative assemblies. And then we have a good corporate partner that comes forward and says, this is important. We'd like to participate in this. We would like to continue to contribute to the community by doing this. Then what happens is that we come back and we say, look, corporations in Oregon aren't carrying their weight. We need to charge them a greater minimum tax in order to do business in Oregon because they're just not carrying their weight. When in fact, the testimony is that, wait a minute, we would have owed this much tax, but because we are participating in these excellent community programs, we owe this much less. And this is just a kind of a lesson for me that what happens is that the tax credits that we're talking about are doing excellent kinds of things. But then it paints all of these corporations with a completely different picture that they are not paying enough tax. And that's of concern to me. So at some point, maybe we better talk about gross taxes and net taxes. And this is a way to make sure that these aren't lost in the process. But if we turn around and create a new minimum tax on corporations in order to get them tax liability back up, you bring your corporate tax liability down to zero after contributing as Mr. and Mrs. Sally Smart
Saint
yes, did in the prior example. You bring your corporate tax down to $20,000. But then what happens is we come in and we implement a $50,000 or $100,000 minimum tax that you will pay irrespective of the fact that you're contributing largely to the well-being of your community. And that is of concern to me.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. We appreciate your testimony. John Miller, Stephen McGrath, Phil, looks like Philip Crane, perhaps?
Yes. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is John Miller. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Solar Industries Association, a group of small business contractors, energy professionals, distributors, and manufacturers that are located throughout the state of Oregon. And I'm speaking here in favor of Senate Bill 819 today. I'm not a fan of being overly dramatic, but without this fix in 819, the community renewables industry in Oregon is dead. It's finished. This will devastate the solar industry in particular without this fix. The problem is not only that if we don't get this fix, the industry's dead, that the slowness the time passage here is also killing business and slowing it down to a crawl. So the faster this fix comes in, the easier it is for businesses to start up again selling these systems. So that's all I have to say. This fix is critical, and we urge you to pass it.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Stephen McGrath. I'm with Commercial Solar Ventures in Portland, and we are one of the companies that John has mentioned that is trying to develop a large number of solar projects in the Portland metro area. At this point, most of that activity is in a waiting state because of exactly what John has mentioned. There is no interest in moving forward with acquisition of tax credits by our industry partners without more certainty on this matter, and we're urging a rapid passage to this because we'd like to see that move forward so we can bring community renewables to Portland and the rest of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Barnhart and the members of the committee, my name is Philip Crane, and I'm also with Commercial Solar Ventures. And just to expand on what John was saying as far as the urgency of this, as we are dealing in the solar industry, of course, we need sun, and one of the best ways to provide opportunities for people to generate power is to actually have the sun shining through the summer. One of the best times to actually do installs is also the summer. The sooner we can get this fixed, the sooner we can get investors such as U.S. Bank and the other banks on board, get some of these installations in, generate some visibility, because right now people don't know anything about solar. It's very new. The technology is new. There's a lot of buzzwords about it, but people really don't understand the potential. And if it is we can't show them the potential, then the momentum, I'm afraid, will actually be lost. Companies like ours will certainly suffer. And I just, again, urge you to pass it, and hopefully we can get this done soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Kevin Lynch, Jason Huser.
Guess I'm by myself.
It
Mr.
looks
Chairman.
That way.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Lynch. I'm the head of policy and regulation for PPM Energy, a company you may not know much about, but we're headquartered in Portland. We have about 200 employees here in the state. We've had a hand in much, if not most, of the wind project development here in Oregon, and we'd like to do an awful lot more. We're getting to the point in the proceedings where, to borrow a line from the late lamented Congressman Mo Udall, everything's been said, but not everybody's had a chance to say it. So I'll try to finish it off right now and be brief. I just wanted to give you a little bit of a perspective from a renewable energy developer's standpoint. This is a very important credit for us. The renewable energy business is almost entirely capital. It's a very capital-intensive business. We plow a lot of money into the ground to get wind projects up and running. We're looking at other alternative technologies as well. They're similarly capital-intensive. So this credit is absolutely valuable compared with a gas plant or a coal plant or something that uses a fuel source. The credit here in Oregon is very important to incenting development inside the boundaries of this state. As I said, we've done a lot here. We'd like to do a lot more. The combination of expansion of the Betsy credit and making it more efficient in terms of its use are two things that are going to, if done, would bring more investment along in this state. But the kicker effect has made the credit highly inefficient, as you've previously heard, and a fix to that is an appropriate thing for the legislature to do, and on behalf of my company, we hope you do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lynch.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Huser with the Eugene Water and Electric Board. I just wanted to jump on because I wasn't sure if any utilities were on the list of people testifying. I'm not a certified smart person, and I think you've probably heard everything about the bill and the mechanics of it. I just want to say that we have a lot of great people at EWEB that do a lot in the way of public-private partnerships with some of the folks you've heard from today, and this bill will help our folks work better with those people, and we urge your aye vote on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? I don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today during the public hearing on Senate Bill 819?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I have submitted on behalf of public utilities some input on 819, and the one comment that I would like to, and Paul has placed it in the public record, one comment I would like to place on the public record as well is the point should be reinforced that in House Bill 2211, there was a fix for the public utility companies relative to the business energy tax credit so that they could take that irrespective of the fact that they may have to pay back some income tax back to the individuals in the state. So that was a partial fix of Senate Bill 408 from last session that was to help. And second thing that I needed to make sure that I placed on the public record, went back in my district and found and discovered that actually the certified public accountants have been acting as agents in the selling of and transferring of these credits. And I did not previously know that. And while I don't know the status of my personal office that I have worked out of back in Eastern Oregon, I recognize that the CPA firms in Oregon have acted as their agents. And so they're most concerned that in that process that they haven't been selling folks a bill of goods. So I'm going to have to declare a potential conflict of interest in that. Accounting firms got involved in this to encourage folks to buy these credits to reduce their tax liabilities, and as was previous testimony had indicated, in some cases it may have actually ended up costing more than the folks that otherwise would not have participated in the tax credit purchases. So I just need to make sure that that's replete for the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. And I take it, if I may ask about, inquire about that, some of these activities were for corporations that pay the corporate tax, and some of them were for individuals to pay the individual income tax.
Individuals, I think mostly, Mr. Chair, because the corporates usually have their own tax departments that are put in touch with some of the folks that are involved in this as a commercial basis. The accountants would then recognize that somebody had a $10 million Oregon tax liability and would go out and shop for $9.7 million and buy tax credits. Now, let me do state this for the record as well. In some states, their treasurer's office have become so active in this market that when they see credits becoming available for 97 cents on the dollar, which will be used within the next 3 months to lower folks' tax liability, that the treasurer rushes out and buys those tax credits, thus forcing up the price on those tax credits in the market. And it's a pretty good return. And so maybe just a bug in the ear of the treasurer's office, but this is a pretty decent place to put your money if you're going to be expending it back out of the general fund in a matter of a few months anyway.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Butler. We may bring that to the attention of Mr. Edwards. Is there anything else for the public hearing?
Mr. Chair, I had a question, I think, for Paul, and that is, so we've been calculating kicker refunds in the same manner since, I guess, maybe since the kicker was created, and why is this only now being raised as a problem?
Representative Rosenbaum, there's a couple of reasons. One is the unusual size. This is our biggest credit percentage we're projecting now for the personal side at 21%. And at the corporate side before the suspension, remember, it's up to 67%. We did have a 50% corporate credit in the past, and a 14% was the highest personal. So we are, I think that has raised the awareness. I think the other thing is that we have, you as a policy decision, have gone to more marketable credits. And what that does is allow companies that that can't use their credits to transfer those to those that have a liability. So there's more demand out there. And I think the third factor that may have come into play here is the change in the apportionment formula to a sales factor has changed the companies that are liable for taxes. And it's made, for example, financial institutions are now paying a higher percentage of the corporate income tax than they did under the old three-factor formula.
Thank you. I might just note while we're in public hearing that Representative Butler's interpretation of the situation may very well be certainly one valid way of looking at it. I think also another valid way of looking at the problems that this bill illustrates is the difficulty of predicting the actual corporate income and therefore the corporate income, the corporate taxes that we currently levy. I think it's very clear from the economists' statements that we've heard every quarter that they really can't predict what the actual corporate income tax is going to be because of the difficulty of predicting corporate profits. So another interpretation of this issue might very well be that we have an extremely volatile tax that needs significant reform in order to make it more predictable for our own purposes. In addition, of course, if we are going to pursue the course that the legislature has been on over the last decade or so, where we attempt to influence business decisions and decisions around other activities through the use of credits, marketable or otherwise, we'd better make certain that those credits are marketable. And when you are unable to predict tax liability because of the kicker, we need a bill like this. So that would be my response, I think, Representative Butler, to your earlier comment. Is there anything else on public hearing? I do intend to open a work session today. All right, with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 819 and open a work session on Senate Bill 819.
Chair,
Representative Butler.
I move Senate Bill 819 as A engrossed on the Senate side to the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves Senate Bill 819 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I don't see any. Please call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
Brown?
Aye.
Representative
Fowler?
Yes.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative
Olson?
Yes. Representative
Reed?
Aye.
Representative
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Representative Wade?
Aye.
Chair Barnhart? Aye. The motion having received the required majority, Senate Bill 819 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Berger, should this go on the consent calendar? Or should we ask Representative Butler to carry?
I think Representative Butler would love to carry this.
All right. Thank you. Representative Butler will carry, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 819. Okay. Representative Olson.
Just want to, if we could suspend the rules, that both Representative Rosenbaum and Representative Gelser vote on that earlier bill.
Oh, thank you. Representative Olson moves that we suspend the rules to allow
859, Senate Bill 859.
Allow Representative Gelser and Representative Rosenbaum to vote on Senate Bill 859. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Rosenbaum, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Representative Rosenbaum votes aye. Representative Gelser, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Gelser votes aye.
Mr. Chair, so she's carrying it.
Thank you. And with that, we close the work session, and the committee is adjourned.